Thank you, Ben. You can be seated. I can't think of a better way to bring in the new year and say goodbye to the old year than to sing that song, you know? And some of us are looking back on this past year and going, wow, I hope this year isn't like the last one. Hope it's better. And some of us are looking down the barrel of what we don't know is going to happen this year. And bless the Lord, oh my soul. We have the confidence that God is in it with us, and that we can rely on His strength, and we can have faith in Him. You know, my name's Britt. I'm one of the pastors here. And today we're going to be studying in 2 Samuel chapter 13. We're going to refer to 14 a little bit. So if you want to turn there, it's a little bit in the front end of the middle. It's 2 Samuel chapter 13. If you have one of the Bibles that we put out at church here, it's page 216. And while you're turning there, I want to just tell you about a couple of things that are coming up. You know, in your program, you have a group booklet. And so one of the things that's important to us at Sunridge is that Sunridge is home to people. And we realize that in a big service like this, you can't know everybody, but we want to make sure you know somebody. So group life is a way that we do that. Look for a group that interests you. I wish we could put pictures on there so you could say, oh, I like how that person looks. Ooh, don't want to go to that group. You know, but there's something you can study, something you can do, something that's near you. It's an opportunity to keep the church small. And some people say, well, your sermons do that, Britt. But on the side, besides my sometimes mediocre sermons, you know, we want to make sure as we reach people and as we grow that you have that connection. People know you and you know others. And then one of the great ways to do that for guys next Sunday is we're going to have a barbecue right after church, after this service. And we're going to eat a lot of meat. If you're vegan, we don't mean to offend you. Bring your little bag of rubber bands or whatever it is that you're eating these days. I know, it's like equal opportunity offender, but no. Some days I eat vegan, so, you know, just save your emails, folks. We might even have some Funyuns for vegetables, I don't know. But it's mainly going to be meat. There might be some buns. I'm not sure yet, because it's guys, and we're putting this thing together. So it's going to be a lot of pork there. Pulled pork, torn apart, shredded, ready to be devoured. So, hey, I don't know if you guys heard this week, but it snowed here in the valley. Did you know that? So, I came over here early the morning after and took some pictures. So I just want to show you some pictures of the campus. The first one here is of our sign. I just, like, that one touched me. I was like, man, that's a beautiful picture, Britt. You could be a photographer. But the snow all piled up. The next one is from the road looking back, and what you should know is people are already hitting our parking lot to do donuts. Maybe it was some of you because you know about us, but there didn't seem to be any bumps up over the curbs, and that's just a winter wonderland there. That could be Michigan, who knows? So next slide is my panorama of the front of our entryway, and of course, I did something wrong because everything's bent there. I don't know. You know, I'm learning. And then the next one is from the office, and I just thought there's a juxtaposition here. There's an irony, snow on palm trees. You should get that connection. And a very poignant photo. And then the last one is I wrote in the snow just so that we could commemorate this. And so 20 years from now, when I'm dead and gone or whatever it is I'm doing, they can show that picture and say it snowed here on December 31st, 2014. And what I noticed when I looked on social media is how happy everybody was in the valley here. It was like, I don't know, it's like the snow brought joy. And you guys were posting like crazy. Some of you got a little annoying. It's like, you know, if I saw one more snowman, lame snowman, you know, if you're from the Midwest, you used to know how to build them, you don't anymore. That's what I learned about me. And it was just, there was so much joy. It felt like at the end of the Grinch Stole Christmas, when the whole town, when they get their presents back and they all stand out, the Whoville people, and they hold hands and they sing, Davu Doris, you know, that thing. By the way, I used to think that was Latin. It's not. It's just Dr. Seuss. It's WHO language. So if you've been singing that, thinking that you're doing the NX Chelsea's Deo or something like that, you're not. You're just singing Whoville. So I would love for that beautiful vibe to continue, but I have to tell you that today our passage is going to take a turn, not just from that, but like David's life's going to take a turn. You know, we've been in the study of David leading up to the December and the Christmas tradition series we did. But, you know, we were calling David the Renaissance man because he was everything. The guy could do anything. You know, he was every man's hero and every woman's dream. You know, he's physical, he's a warrior, but he's a poet and a musician. And he had it all going on. Except just before we started our Christmas series, we saw his life start to unravel. And we've even changed our artwork for this to demonstrate or kind of symbolically say that David's wheels are going to fall off. And it's not pretty. And today is just a really good reminder of that. It's not going to be happy. And it's going to be PG. If you have little kids in here, I hope that some of you took a moment to read 2 Samuel 13. It's like there's some stuff in there that if I had a little kid, I don't know. I'm not going to do anything weird, I promise you, but there's a lot of tension in this passage. And, you know, it's gritty what we're going to read today. It comes from your guts. It's visceral because the Old Testament is how life is. It's one of the things I like about the Old Testament. You're going to see that if you think you have a dysfunctional family, David, this remarkable man, has a really jacked up family. It's going to go really badly. Happy New Year, by the way. It's life the way it is. And one of my favorite things to do is start in one place in the Bible and go to another place, like just verse by verse. I love teaching books in the Bible, and I've loved teaching David, just taking his story as it came, because it forces us to deal with things that we would not deal with. I would not write a sermon on this topic. It would not be my top choice to start the new year with, but this is where we find ourselves. And at this church, we're committed to being uncompromising about how we teach the Bible. We want to teach it with soft edges. We want to teach it appropriately. We want to recognize that all of us are broken and we don't have any spiritual pride in how we teach it, but it's uncompromising. And so we find ourselves in this weird place today, and you're going to meet five people. One of them, I guess you already know, David. You know David. But you're going to meet a woman named Tamar, who is David's daughter. And then you're going to meet two brothers from another mother. One is named Amnon, and then the other brother you might be more familiar with, Absalom. They are half-brothers. David is their father, but they have different moms. And Tamar is Absalom's sister. So that makes her Amnon's half-sister. And then you're going to meet a man named Jonadab, who is born from David's brother. So he's a cousin. So it's all in the family, right? But they're going to put the dis in dysfunction. Let's start in 2 Samuel 13, verse 1. In the course of time, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom. The beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. Amnon became frustrated to the point, another word would be obsessed with, to the point of illness on account of his sister Tamar, because she was a virgin and it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. Now you should make a connection there right away between the way the writer puts it, David is in love with Tamar, but he wants to do something to her. And this is not what love does. Love does things for people, not to them. Verse 3, now Amnon had a friend named Jonadab, son of Shimeah, David's brother, and Jonadab was a very shrewd man. Another word for shrewd here would be manipulative. And he asked Amnon, "Why do you, the king's son, look so haggard morning after morning? You look bummed out. Won't you tell me?" And Amnon said to him, "I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." So this obsession that he has, and he uses the word love, this is not love. This is lust. There's a difference. And so Jonadab gives him a plan of how he can accomplish this thing that he wants to do. Verse 5, he says, "Go to bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say, 'I would like to see my sister Tamar to come and give me something to eat and let her prepare the food in my sight so I may watch her and then eat it from her hand.'" And so Jonadab, in helping Amnon do this thing, he's an accomplice to what's going to happen. And this plan is exactly what Amnon does, with David's blessing, I might add. And so Tamar makes him food, but he refuses to eat it with everybody else in the room. So continuing on in verse 9, he says, "Send everyone out of here." And what he's going to do here is he's going to try and get alone with Tamar. And unmarried women are forbidden to be with a man alone, according to Old Testament law. But Amnon's going to leverage his family relationship here. So he says, "Send everyone out of here." So everyone left. And then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food here into my bedroom so that I can eat it from your hand." And Tamar took the bread she had prepared and brought it to her brother Amnon in his bedroom. And in verse 11, when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her. And he said, "Come to bed with me, my sister." "Don't, my brother," she said to him. And I think it's noteworthy to see how both of them refer to their family relationship for different reasons. "Don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing." Verse 13, she continues her negotiation with Amnon. "What about me? Where could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You would be like one of the wicked fools in Israel. Please speak to the king, and he will not keep me from being married to you." It's possible, not condoned in Scripture, but it's possible for a half-sister to marry her half-brother. It's going on. And she says, at the very least, do this bad thing in a way that's respectable. And in verse 14, he refused to listen to her. And since he was stronger than she, he raped her. The implication here is that she fought with Amnon. And because he's stronger, he overcomes her. And he refuses to listen to any plea that she makes. Amnon is pathological. And then in verse 15, it says that Amnon hated her with intense hatred. And in fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. It says in the passage, he said to her, "Get out of here." This sending away with disgust and derision adds insult to injury and possibly puts guilt on her. Isn't it remarkable how real the Bible can be? That here we are thousands of years later, and yet the insight into the pathology of what happens in an assault like this, it's spot on. In verse 18, Tamar was wearing a richly ornamented robe, for this was the kind of garment the virgin daughters of the king wore. This would be symbolic of her purity and the respect that she is due. And after this happens, in verse 19, Tamar puts ashes on her head, which signifies her embarrassment, her mourning, and her banishment. and tears the ornamented robe, symbolically demonstrating what has happened to her dignity. And she put her hand on her head and went away weeping aloud as she went. Just as her robe is torn, her dignity and her humanness are taken. In verse 20, her brother Absalom says to her, "Has that Amnon, your brother, been with you?" It's almost like he knew. Isn't not? Maybe he saw her go in the room. Maybe he heard the scuttle in the palace. But he knew that something had happened. He sees her torn robe. He hears her crying. And he deducts what's happened. "So be quiet now, my sister. He's your brother. Don't take this thing to heart." Really? Wow. Absalom feels all the complication of what has just happened in the palace with his family. And Tamar lived in her brother Absalom's house from there on, a desolate woman. So Absalom's kind of mixed on this. He trivializes what's happened in a way, by saying, "Don't say anything." And that's going to become apparent as we go through our message, say why he might have done that. But he's planning his revenge. But yet, it's so poignant to me to see that after this happens, Tamar, it says that she is now a desolate woman. She's empty. And in verse 21, when King David heard all this, he was furious. But that's all he was. He's furious. He does nothing. Verse 22, Absalom never said a word to Amnon after this. Can you imagine the tension in the palace at a meal, passing in the hallways? He never said a word, good or bad, but he hated Amnon, because he had disgraced his sister. And reading on through the rest of 13 and 14, 2 years later, Absalom creates a plot. He sets an ambush. He tells David, "We're going to have this. We have the sheep shearing upcoming. There's always a big celebration when this happens. Let Amnon come to that. You come too, David." David says, "I can't come." Maybe he doesn't want to be around this uncomfortable situation. He wants to pretend like it hasn't happened. So he doesn't go, but Amnon goes. And Absalom directs his workers to ambush Amnon, and they murder him. And so then Absalom has to flee. He runs to his former hometown, the place of his mother's birth in Geshur. And so he's banished now. Amnon is dead. Tamar lives in desolation, and Absalom is banished. And the parts of chapter 13 refer to David. They say that he wept bitterly about this, and he mourned for his son every day. So he's furious, and he mourns. And Absalom is in exile for 3 years. And then Joab, David's sidekick, and number two guy, his general, he convinces David to bring Absalom back to the city. So he does, but it's not real forgiveness. It's only partial forgiveness. And he doesn't see him. He brings him back to the city, but he can't be in the palace, and David won't see him. He can't get an audience with the king. So he's back, but these years and years go with no interaction with David. And this is going to trigger even more dysfunction as we look at it next week. Happy New Year. You know, this part of the passage reminds me of a number of years ago. We had a young couple at that time in our home group, and they became Christians. They were all fired up about starting to read their Bible, and they started in the Old Testament. They started in the beginning, and you know, we said, "Yeah, I could do it," you know. And then She has like this really nice voice, you know, it's like real soft, and like she just comes across as the nicest person. She said, you know, we thought that we'd read the Bible together as a family, and we thought it was, you know, I'm thinking of like when I was in Sunday school, and there's all these happy little stories, and we thought we'd have these nice little Bible times. And she goes, I don't like it. There's people getting murdered, and God is wiping them all out with a flood. I'm like, yeah. It's the way it is sometimes. So let's make something of this. And so what I'd like to do in the time I have remaining is just to click back through these five people that we met in the beginning. And I think we can learn something from each person. Kind of, there's a reminder. Each one of them, like something comes forward that to me is like a lesson. When I look at Tamar, she's a reminder to me that sin always has victims. Sin does not happen in a little box that hurts one person. When we sin, big and small, it always has this shrapnel effect that goes through our family, through our church, through our relationships, through our community. It affects everything. And so this is a reminder that that's what happens. There's an organization, the acronym is RAINN, R-A-I-N-N, and they have statistics. This stands for Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network. And I'm going to put these stats up here. It's remarkable that every 107 seconds, someone is sexually assaulted in America. That adds up to 293,000 times a year. And 68% of sexual assault cases are never reported. And 98% of rapists will never spend a day in prison. And 2/3 of these assaults that occur are committed by someone that knows the victim. Tamar appeals to Amnon in every way possible. She says to him, don't do this wicked thing. You will violate the law of God if you do this. What about me? I will live in disgrace. What about you? You will look like the other fools in Israel. And if you can't stop, like at least stop now and marry me. Go to the king and see if you can. And then she physically fights him. There's not more that she could have done. This is a reminder that sin has victims, and we live in a broken world. And there are people in this world that are our protectors. They are the sheepdogs that protect the sheep. And they're not all perfect. But remember that we need that protection. Because there are people that are as broke can be. This sin has a victim. Her name is Tamar. She's a person. She's a beautiful woman who had all of the opportunity and promise ahead of her as one of the king's daughters. And yet, this happens. It's not fair. But we live in a broken world. If this has happened to you, and I mean, I put these stats up there, they're staggering. This means that in this group of people today, that there are people that this has happened to. And there may be people that have done so. If this has happened to you, you deserve justice. I want to say that to you. You deserve justice. And you need God's grace. You need God's grace every day, probably more at the micro level than that. You need it moment by moment. You might be hoping for one more drop of grace to get you through this next thought. You deserve justice, but you need grace. The Apostle Paul in his letter to the Corinthians in chapter 12, verse 9. He says this. He says, this is God speaking to Paul, and the Lord says to him, my grace is sufficient for you. Now, the context of that is that Paul has this thing that weighs him down. The Bible calls it his thorn in the flesh, but we don't know what it is. It could be a physical ailment. Maybe it was the guilt that he carried for having murdered and persecuted people. And now he is on the other side of that, and he has all these regrets. I don't know what it was, but the Lord says to him, this thing that you cannot escape, and for some reason God didn't remove it, my grace is sufficient for you. Sufficient means it's adequate. It's like, it's not an overabundance, but my grace will get you through. For my power is made perfect in weakness. The very things that break us in our lives are the place where God brings his grace and displays his power. Because how are you going to ever get over that? How are you going to move on? Only through God's grace. Tamar is a reminder that sin has victims. Secondly, Amnon is a reminder of how low we can go. Amnon wants what he wants. He wants it his way. He wants it when he wants it. He wants it just what he wants, and he wants it now. And in spite of every obstacle in front of him and every option he had, he still said, I want it now. And this reminds us of how low we can go. You see, we all have passions. We all have desires. We all have things we want to do, accomplish. And sometimes those things, in order to get them, we will cross boundaries that God does not intend for us to cross. But we will do it. It doesn't have to just think beyond what we've been talking about and think just about all the options that we have today and all the things, the decisions that we can make and the things that you want most. What are we willing to do for that? What lines are we willing to cross? Because Amnon shows us that it doesn't matter if you're a king's son and you can probably have whatever you want if you just wait a little bit. He just wants what he wants when he wants it, and he doesn't care what happens to anybody else. He had the potential to inherit the throne, and yet this act changes the direction of his life completely. He dies. He loses his life. How different his life is because of this one time when he wanted what he wanted, when he wanted it, he didn't care. The Apostle Paul, again, writing to the Corinthians, they were a dysfunctional bunch, by the way. In 1 Corinthians 9, he says this about himself. He says, I beat my body to make it my slave, so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified. The picture here is of an athlete. And he's saying, I'm like an athlete. It's like, I have to discipline myself. There are things that I want to eat. There are things that I don't want to do right now in terms of physical exertion. It's like, but I will control that. Because if I don't, I'm just going to be a castaway. That's what happened to Amnon. There are things that we want that will cost others and will cost us in the long run because of what we're willing to do to get them. Thirdly is Absalom, who is a reminder to me of how bitterness destroys us. Do you know that the name Absalom interpreted means my father is peace? And yet Absalom will know very little of that. And the sad part of this is that he has every reason to be bitter. But this bitterness is going to eat him up. And he plots and he schemes. And chapter 13, verse 23 says, 2 years later after this event, all this seething anger comes out. If Amnon had a lust, Absalom had a bloodlust. And he's like a time bomb, just waiting to explode. And he allows this incident in his life to steal from him who God intended him to be. Because he was in the line to be king. And what we see of him, he's like, he's a great warrior and he's influential. Probably the most prominent son until Solomon kind of comes on the scene. And so he has all this promise, and yet this thing is going to eat at him and steal away from him the plans that God had for him. And what he does, like his father, is he recruits others to do his dirty work. There are those of us that are sitting here today that we've been wronged. And maybe even harder is that someone we love has been wronged. And this eats at us. And it overtakes us. The writer of Hebrews in chapter 12, verse 15 said, "See to it that no one misses the grace of God and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many." What a great picture of bitterness. If you allow it to overtake you, you will miss the grace of God, which is the most precious thing that we have, the grace of God, and yet we will miss it. And in its place will be this seed that was planted and then watered by our bitterness, and it becomes a root. And you know, like, have you seen like how plants' roots take over everything? I mean, they wreck our driveways, they wreck our patios, they get into your plumbing, they just go everywhere. I mean, a tree in your yard, I had an arborist tell me this one time, that tree, its roots go out three times as far in every direction as its height. I'm like, this is a tree that ate Temecula in my mom's front yard, you know, when I had it. I mean, like, who knows where those roots are? Probably wrapped around some of your houses. This is how bitterness is. It takes root and it spreads and you can almost never get rid of it. So he says, don't let it happen. Don't let it even get started. Fourthly is Jonadab. And he's a reminder that all advice is not good. He's a cousin. He's also a bad friend that gives terrible advice. As I mentioned, the writer calls him shrewd. Shrewd in a worldly sense. Like shrewd because he was looking to get up on everybody. Shrewd in that he's plotting and he always has an angle. Because remember, he's not the direct son. He's a cousin. He's a nephew. So how does he get what he wants? How does he get his props and get power in the palace where everyone else is closer to the king? How does he do it? His adaptation is to scheme and to plot. And so he gives this ridiculous advice that flatters Amnon and inflames this thing that he wants to do. He concocts the plan that lets the thing happen. And what's sad is you can get ahead like that. Maybe some of you in your business, you've seen this happen. Your place of work, there are people that know how to work the system. Their character is low, but their promotion factor is high. Or maybe someone's weaseled into your family and broken your family up. Maybe someone's doing this to your kids at school. Or it's like there are just people that know how to break things apart for their own end. That is who Jonadab is. And he gets away with it because it works. And it works because we're all susceptible to it. We want to hear what we want to hear. And so we surround ourselves with people that tell us what we want to hear. Amnon is undone because the guy he's listening to has an angle. A real friend would have confronted Amnon. Proverbs 27:6 says, "Wounds from a friend can be trusted." Do you have friends that can tell you the truth? Or if somebody tells us what we don't want to hear, are they off the list? Like, oh, they tell us something about somebody that we care about that's true, but we don't want to listen to it. The wounds of a friend are faithful. Jonadab is a reminder that our friendship should be built on honesty and integrity and the truth, and to not surround ourselves with Jonadabs. Lastly is David, and he's a reminder that leadership carries with it responsibility. David has emotions. He's furious. He weeps. He mourns. But he doesn't do a thing. Not to Amnon, not for Absalom, nothing. And here's the problem. He's the only person that can do anything. Who's going to mess with the king's sons? David is in the place that God has put him to do something. And he's not going to do anything. He's going to get all frothed up and emotional about it. But for whatever reason, he doesn't act. He's paralyzed. In the 1700s, there was a man who was born in Dublin and later became part of the House of Commons in England. His name is Edwin Burke, and he's credited with this statement: "All that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing." That's David. He's the absentee leader. He's literally the absentee father. And it's not the first time. Remember when kings go off to war, David stayed home? He's absent. If you're a father, if you're a boss, if you're a mom, if you're a coach, if you're a teacher, if you're a grandpa or a grandma, or you're a leader, you're an elder, you're a pastor, you're a ministry leader, I don't care. It's like God has put you there to do leadership. And we cannot abdicate that. We have to wear the yoke that God has given us. You know, it dawned on me that this event, there's a trial for everybody in this. Each name that I've mentioned is a victim in their own way. Tamar, certainly. Amnon, he's a victim of his own pathology. Who knows what Amnon experienced growing up, being in the king's palace, you know, with all the privileges and entitlement. Maybe he just thought, this is the way it is. I can take whatever I want. I have enough money. I have the power. I can do what I want. Absalom is certainly a victim of his own bitterness. And it's like, I mean, I can give him props on that, right? It's like, I know why he did this. But he's victimized by it. Jonadab, probably a victim of his own desire to be in, and he's not. And David is his own victim as well. He cannot act. I found myself asking three questions after studying this passage. The first one I asked was, like, who's the worst sinner of all? Who's the worst person? Is it Amnon? Or is it Absalom who committed murder? Capital One murder. Maybe it's Jonadab because he's the one that put the whole plan together and let it happen. Or maybe it's David because he's the guy that should have done something and he just stood there and let it happen right in front of him. And then the second question came to me, beyond like who's the worst, then I asked myself, which one am I most like? Am I Amnon? Am I the man that will take what I want when I want it? Will I manipulate the system so that I can get it? Am I Absalom? Am I overtaken with so much bitterness for anybody that's ever done me wrong? It's like, man, I'm going to get them back one day. Or am I like Jonadab, who from my own devices and sometimes not even, maybe even being aware why I decide, but like to work the system toward my own end? Or am I David? That I sit idly by and I watch things happen in my world, in my small world, in the big world, and I don't act. I just get mad about it. But I'm not going to act. And then I ask myself, can God forgive each one of these people? Can He forgive me? And can He forgive you? I love the picture that Isaiah gives us, the prophet, when he says in Isaiah 1:18, "Come now and let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be white as snow. And though they are red as crimson, they'll be like wool." What a great picture of the stain of sin. And yet Jesus, through His redemptive act on the cross, cleanses us. The Apostle Paul, who I mentioned is a persecutor and a murderer of Christians, wrote this in Romans 3:24, "We are justified freely by His grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus." In Jesus' own words, He said to the woman caught in adultery, "I don't condemn you either. Go and sin no more." So I don't know where you are in this story. I don't know if this has happened to you and you just need even a drop of God's grace. I don't know if you find yourself in the story somewhere else as a person who just doesn't do anything or whatever your story is. I can tell you that the answer is Jesus Christ. There is no other answer. To redeem us or to give us the grace to take the next step in this life we have here until we're ultimately glorified and all things are made right and brought under Jesus Christ, as we're promised. That will happen. In the meantime, we live in the gap. I don't know what your need is, but I know that Jesus Christ is the answer. At the end of our service, we're going to have a prayer team up here. And I know that a talk like this can elicit all kinds of stuff. I want you to know that they're available to pray with you, to talk with you, to connect with you. We have groups through Celebrate Recovery that can help you take the long road that you might need to take to get to a good place. But as a church, we want to be here for you. Whatever your situation is, will you pray with me?